Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
No time in history has anyone had access to these kinds of technologies to understand the biology at the level that we can do now. That's a huge, huge difference maker. And so that's one of the ways that certainly our tools are being used, others as well. Like when you're generating a vaccine, what kind of effect it's having on, you know, on the patient, on their biology, on their immune system. And so we can see this at a level that we just could not even contemplate even a few years ago.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. I am your host, Danny Fortson, West Coast correspondent for the Sunday Times, and I am back from my quote-unquote holiday, sheltering place here in my house in Oakland. Can't say it was the most relaxing or restful vacation, but we're all healthy, so I'm going to still count it as a win. And now we're back with another podcast. And depending on how the next day goes, this will hopefully be the first of 2 episodes headed your way in the next few days. So just keep your eye on the feed. On this pod, though, we have a very interesting guest, Serge Saksonov. He is an entrepreneur who fled the Soviet Union as it collapsed. He ended up in New York. And these days, he runs 10X Genomics, a maker of a very powerful machine that allows researchers to see down to the single cellular level. And if you don't know what that really means, it's fine. I didn't really either. But Saksonov is very good at explaining why this is a big deal, especially as we race to find a vaccine for COVID-19. So 10X's machines are being used around the world in labs who are dissecting the virus, trying to figure out how it works, and that's how we might try to attack it. So you can think of their machines, I'm just making this up, but think of it like if you saw some security camera footage of a bad guy robbing a store or something, and it was really grainy, maybe it was dark, whatever. You can have that, or you can have a perfectly crystal clear portrait mode from your Apple iPhone. Picture of the bad guy. That's kind of the difference from what was previously possible and what you can do on 10X's machines, more or less. Saksonov also, he took the company public last year, and as of this week, it's worth about $6 billion. And again, this company was founded in 2015, about 5 years ago, so not bad going. One of its early backers was SoftBank, which of course is now itself desperately attempting to stave off its own implosion. Point is, there are lots of strands here, and I think you'll really enjoy it. So, via Zoom, as always these days, I give you Serge Saksonov, founder and CEO of 10X Genomics. Perhaps we could start just a brief description of what 10X Genomics is for the people out there in the world who may have never heard of you. And then we can kind of dive into what you guys are up to now and kind of the backstory and all of that.
Yeah. So we build tools, products to help scientists understand biology, to kind of to make a concrete thing of, we built an instrument, think of it like an espresso machine. And so our customers buy them from us, and then they buy cartridges to put into that instrument to run, do various, measure different kinds of things about biology. They're biological samples, like right. a sample of blood or yes, a piece of tissue, like a piece of skin or a cancer, things like that. We kind of developed a set of technologies over the years that allow people, like scientists, to see things they could not see before, like really, really high level of resolution and scale, measure many, many biological objects like DNA, RNA, proteins, cells, tissues, things like that. And so they're able to make discoveries they could never do before. And so we've have like well over 700 publications, like papers that have come out of scientific labs, our customers, using our products to make those discoveries. And across many different areas of biology, oncology, like cancer, neuroscience, infectious disease, just about every area of biology, the fundamental discoveries in like top journals.
Effectively, what you're doing is allowing much greater resolution of what researchers might be looking at and trying to find.
Yeah, I mean, that's at the highest level, that's the right way to look at it. That's what we set out to do. What we're particularly well known for is this idea of single cell analysis, ability to look at individual cells in very, very large numbers. So taking kind of your tissue or your blood sample, and then measuring individual cells across thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of cells in that sample. So like going deep into each cell. So that gives you that kind of resolution.
Is this another way to think about it, is kind of delivering on the promise of genomics? It's been a long time since the human genome was mapped, and it was...
Yeah.
There was an immediate rush of sky-high expectations about what this was going to do to healthcare, and what we ended up with was 23andMe. I know that's obviously a simplification, but it feels like it's been a much slower burn.
So I have a lot of thoughts on that, and I would say that, look, the fundamental, the crux of the matter is that we actually understand very little biology, and we continuously underestimate just how little we understand. So doing the human genome was absolutely like necessary, incredibly valuable, all kinds of like, it's just a foundation for so much science. But the problem is that it's only the first step, and there's like way more to go. So, people ask about whether it's like, was it overhyped? Was it like the wrong thing to do or whatever? Like, no, I mean, it's absolutely the right thing to do, and it produced enormous amounts of value. It's just that the challenge of understanding biology is so much greater than what we had necessarily thought. And so kind of the way that, we see the world is like, well, okay, so you map out the genome, but now the question is like, what do all those genes do? Right? So that's what we at 10x hope to enable the world to do, and is actually understand all of that downstream biology and how it all works together, which ultimately is how we will get at cures.
Got you. So there's a little problem out there in the world right now.
Yes.
With COVID. So can you talk about what you're just describing applies to COVID, and kind of what you guys are doing, and kind of your view of the landscape, and getting back to the first point of like return to normalcy, kind of feels like vaccine has to be a part of that, and kind of where we are on that path.
Yeah. So I would say it's been like incredibly, it's been fascinating and in many ways inspiring to see what's been happening over the last month and a half in the world of science. In our case, a lot of our research, like a lot of our customers were actually getting shut down throughout March. And, for some in Asia earlier, back in January, February. But a lot of them are actually working and reorienting their research toward COVID. Just like people who are working on all kinds of other problems are all sort of now focused on the one thing. It's pretty inspiring. Like I can't think of any example in like history where there's been so much brain power focused on one single problem. Now, going back to sort of your original question, like how do we get back to normalcy? What does it take? So yes, ultimately you need a vaccine. I think that's how, or you need to get to immunity, kind of population level immunity, which means either enough people get it or enough people get a vaccine. And vaccines generally take time. This is like it's science underlying it. There's like a biology that you need to figure out. The typical time frames are measured in years, 2+ years. I think you know, we're looking here, given the amount of focus here, there's reason to be more optimistic, but, you know, I wouldn't bet that it's going to take any less than 18 months, let's say, to get to a vaccine.
I just wanted to ask on that point. So I was reading something that an interview with Larry Brilliant from Google Org, et cetera, and he was saying that he thinks they'll a winning vaccine will be developed sometime in the next 2 to 4 months. Then there's testing, there's efficacy testing, safety testing, industrial scale up, and that gets you to the 12 to 18 month thing. But he was basically saying, which is what you just said, it's like, it appears that a vaccine is doable. And I'm trying to understand why everybody seems so confident that that is, in fact, a reachable goal. Is there something about this biologically that says, okay, well, you know, it's going to take us time to figure out X, Y, and Z about this virus, but we'll know how to attack it at some point with a vaccine?
Well, so I would say, you know, you want to be a little careful. I don't think we can say with 100% certainty that you can get a vaccine, but I think you can have a high degree of confidence just based on the fact that vaccination works against such a large number of pathogens. I think it's more of an empirical question than kind of a question of fundamental science right now. But I think there's reasons to be confident because we have developed vaccines for a huge range of pathogens. There's definitely places in the news that could potentially accelerate the development and really get things sooner. And, you know, Bill Gates is investing in kind of preemptive scale up of manufacturing so that you do not stack that time frame on top of initially proving the safety and efficacy so you can get going immediately. So there's ways to shorten it. I just, you know, the bar is pretty high. First, we need to understand the science to figure out like what that vaccine would be. And then you need to prove to yourself that it's safe. And that bar is pretty high because you're going to be giving it to just about everyone, right? And that it's actually effective because, again, you're going to be giving it to everyone. You're going to be making assumptions, all kinds of hugely, hugely economically expensive assumptions based on that.
Yeah, for sure. It has struck me since this is kind of all blown up that everybody in the kind of epidemiology world and in this kind of science world is be like, okay, we will get a vaccine. There seems to be a level of confidence there that to me is a bit surprising, but I don't know anything about vaccine development or anything, but it just does seem like it's almost a given. It's a question of, is it 18 months? Is it 2 years? Is it 12 months? Whatever it may be.
I think it's reasonable. Just, I think, again, based on our sort of knowledge of historic empirical evidence, what we've done in the past and our knowledge, I mean, this is what the immune system is kind of supposed to do. I mean, on top of it, look, we've got tools like ours and other companies that make that. No time in history has anyone had access to these kinds of technologies to understand the biology at that level that we can do now. That's a huge, huge difference maker. And so that's one of the ways that certainly our tools are being used, others as well. Like when you're generating a vaccine, what kind of effect it's having on, you know, on the patient, on their biology, on their immune system. And so we can see this at a level that we just could not even contemplate even a few years ago.
So what are you guys up to on this front?
Our goal is to provide, again, these tools and technologies to the maximum extent possible to our customers who are working on this. And again, there has been a sea change in just a few weeks of just everyone orienting their research programs to this problem.
It's almost like a kind of a Manhattan Project, but globally.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, right? Because it's not centrally coordinated in any way, but it's everyone has the same goal. And so everyone is kind of all of a sudden rowing in the same direction, maybe independently. Maybe not perfectly kind of in communication with each other, but everyone is going in that direction. So, yeah, our goal is to move as fast as we can to satisfy any customer concern. They need an instrument. We have a lot of customers placing instruments in biosafety labs. Once an instrument goes in there, it doesn't come back out. And every time a customer asks for that, we do whatever we can to help them with that. And that, you know, obviously, whatever help we can in terms of interpreting results or helping them with their experiments, we try to do that.
Are you guys an essential service? Or are you guys also on lockdown?
We're an essential service because, again, our products are being used to understand the disease and like just about every aspect of it and to develop vaccines, to develop therapeutics.
Right.
Yeah, that has been definitely a pretty tough period because we had to ramp down pretty quickly. Number of priorities, make sure the employees are safe and make sure that everyone feels safe and taken care of. But yeah, we do need to keep our production going. And so that's our second imperative, is to make sure that we can keep our product to keep going to our customers. And so we have a reduced crew in manufacturing operations that keeps producing the product, and some R&D functions around that to help support it. And then also, you know, there's more products that we have in our pipeline that are going to be, we see as being important for these efforts. So we're also trying to push those forward as well. It's a balance and it's hard.
I was going to say, because are you at the office right now?
I'm actually right now at the office, yes.
Because yeah, I was just thinking, looking at your background, which looks very office-y. That's like the first office background I've seen on any of my, I don't know how many dozens of Zoom calls I've done now. Everybody, it's usually like in some kind of awkward corner of somebody's house that they've set up as an impromptu office.
Yeah, most, I mean, this is the first time I've been back in a while. But
oh, really?
So, I mean, we try to minimize the amount of interface and interactions we have here. But my house is not so, that much more exciting, I have to say.
I'd love to go back and just get a sense of like how you came to start this company. Like, what were you doing before? How did you end up starting it, the journey?
Yeah, I don't know how far back you want me to go, but...
Are you from Russia?
Yeah, no, so I was born in Moscow, so Russia, but yeah. I grew up in a place called Tajikistan in Central Asia. Oh, yeah. And my family immigrated out when I was 13, went to New York. That's where we ended up, and lived in Washington Heights initially, for those who know the geography there.
It
was interesting. It was the early 90s. I went to high school in the Bronx.
So you came out right as the USSR was...
Yeah, it was falling apart. Exactly. It was a really weird time, too. It's like, it actually gives you a sense of how... I think one of the things I learned, I mean, going through that period and also just growing up in the USSR, you sort of learned that you can't assume that the way things are, they're going to continue perpetually.
Well, it's really interesting. This whole experience for me is like, it showed me just how complacent we were about kind of everything. Because I was born in 77 mm-hmm. and kind of, at least in my adult life, it's, you know, we had 2008, which was... traumatic in different ways, and you had 2001, which was traumatic, but kind of everything, at least from my experience, was rolled along with some kind of changes around the edges.
Exactly. History of the world is very different, right? Like, yeah, so for me it was, you know, if you had to ask anyone back in like 1987 or something, the USSR is going to be around forever, because it's like my experience has been around forever.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it wasn't there at all and everything changed. It was a good thing that it changed, but like again, the unpredictability of history was pretty striking, and you kind of internalized that. So yeah, so my kind of my story is like I was went to high school in New York. So that was interesting, kind of growing up learning English and all of that, and then went to college. I studied applied math, but I was always interested in biology. Just happened to be sort of not as good in lab and had more ability with math. So that was, and I ended up initially pre-med and realized that I was, like my parents wanted me to be a doctor. And at some point early on in college, I realized it was just like, I was just terrified of kind of knowing what I was going to have to do for the next 20 years. And then there was a particular moment that I remember it. So this, my advisor that I was doing research in, whose lab I was doing research at the time, was also an entrepreneur. Like, he had started a company, so he's a pretty famous scientist. And as I was kind of thinking about what I want to do with my life, I went to a panel. It was an entrepreneurship panel. There was a point at which someone asked the questions like, well, you guys are talking about, you know, it's so great to start companies, but what about your sort of life work balance, and how do you manage other priorities? And one of the people on the panel kind of started answering the question and was kind of talking about how it could be challenging, et cetera. And then my advisor just kind of cut in, and he was kind of like that. Let me just interject. And I would just want to say that if you're asking that question, you're probably not fit to be an entrepreneur. And it's a pretty blunt kind of way of saying it. And it's like, I totally, Wally, that's the name of my advisor, had kind of that way with words. But it also somehow it's really struck a chord with me. I was like, this sort of idea of having an all-encompassing mission and goal of building, like committing yourself 100% to something. I think that was kind of a trigger point for me, where I started thinking like, building companies would be something it would really resonate with me. And that's something that I really want to do. That's part of the reason I ultimately came out to the West Coast for grad school. I did a PhD in something called bioinformatics, so computer science and statistics and biology.
Was that Stanford?
Yeah,
or
that
Berkeley
was Stanford. And then, kind of as I was finishing up my PhD, had a bunch of ideas about what I wanted to do. And a lab mate and a friend of mine and I started talking about thinking about the world of the future where genome sequencing is going to be more prevalent. How are you going to tell people about their genomes? And so we started thinking about starting a company. And that time kind of ended up meeting up with Ann Wojcicki and Linda Avey, who were about to start 23andMe. And so you mentioned 20. So that was original founding team of 23andMe coming out of grad school. So that was my... So that was, again, that was back in the day. Like early days, we were the very first ones to be interpreting human genomes at any kind of scale. It was fun. It was very interesting. It was exciting. It was creating new ground. The thing there that was a little that I felt ultimately somewhat constrained is that we're relying on technology that was developed by other companies. And I think that's still kind of the right business approach fundamentally for what we wanted to do. But it places constraints, right, in terms of what can you actually learn. And so that kind of led me on the path to like kind of go upstream and think about what are the tools that we actually have, what are the technologies that we have to measure, to be able to measure and manipulate biology. And so I joined a company, it was called QuantaLife. It was started by a close friend of mine, who was a co-founder. I joined as a...
How long were you at 23?
4 years. So I joined an early startup where we're building an instrument to measure DNA very precisely. So it was a very different kind of environment, very different. It was a lot of fun. That company ended up getting acquired by a larger company, but there is where I met some of the colleagues that ultimately with whom I started 10x later. So QuantaLife was acquired in 2011. I left it in 2012, and then middle of 2012, I got together with Ben Heinsohn, who was the chief science officer and co-founder of the previous company of QuantaLife. And he's a chemist by training. Again, my background is computational biology, so I'm kind of from the other side, but we worked really well together at QuantaLife. In fact, it was really, really fun because it was like the kinds of things that he can come up with that sometimes would just feel like magic to me. It was just like, hey, Ben, is such and such possible? He's just like, yeah. And I was just like, it feels so productive working together. Right. And so, so we were kind of like at that point, middle of 2012, we're unemployed and kind of started trying to think about what we want to do next and started talking about different ideas and kind of where the world was going to go in the coming years and realizing that a lot of problems that kind of needed addressing really came down to some sort of core features. You needed to have a lot more resolution and a lot more scale to be able to measure different elements of biology. And so we set out to develop a kind of a technology that could deliver many products to enable, but on the basis of much higher resolution, much higher scale.
Right.
That was the start, 2012. And again, we just had ideas. I mean, literally we were in the coffee shop and started kind of talking about drawing out sketches in a notebook. After that, had a third founder joined us, again, our colleague from the previous company. His background is in hardware and mechanical engineering. So from the very beginning, 10x, and this is probably one of the most defining sort of characteristics of the company, is that we were very multidisciplinary, very different areas kind of coming together. And we had, from the very beginning, we had a lot of kind of mutual respect for each other's areas of expertise. And we tried to nurture that as we built the company through the years and kind of as we added more and more to the company.
I know you guys went public was about 6 months ago, roughly.
Yeah, it feels like a totally different world now. But yes, we went public on September 13th of 2019.
Right. How was the experience of raising money for, because obviously everybody says, hardware is hard, biology is harder. And obviously there's 2012, but then the whole Theranos debacle, was kind of slowly growing in the background. But I guess at that time it was probably more the hype cycle. Was it difficult to raise money for?
So it's interesting. Yeah. So for us initially, kind of when we were raising money, it was definitely not a great climate. 2012, 2013, some since 2014, because the kind of thing we're doing was just like hard, like building hardware, chemistry is like physical stuff, right? It just takes a lot of money and the outcome is kind of uncertain. People were definitely not, most investors were not super excited about the area for sure. Yeah. At the same time, some of the, like, we ended up getting, like, the best investors in life sciences and healthcare. And I think they just kind of look at things from first principles. So the people who are sort of not necessarily following the herd, we are actually really fortunate with our investors in the VC years to get the right people aboard. We definitely were sort of outside of the mainstream of what people were raising. In terms of Theranos, they came a bit later. If you remember, like, Theranos never raised money from any VCs that actually knew what they were doing. so it didn't, like, yes. It was kind of like we never touched on us at all.
Yeah. How much did you guys raise?
In private rounds, it was just about $250 million through all the different rounds. Yeah, the most difficult ones are always kind of the early ones. Those are most uncertain. I mean, when we're raising our seed money, which is not exactly a venture round, it was kind of friends and, you know, former investors. We literally had 10 slides. That was the entirety of the company. It's a slide deck. Right. We had a slide that showed, kind of outlined all the problems we had to figure out. And our investors were asking us, like, also, how are you guys going to do this? And we're like, we actually don't know. Like, that's why we need the money. So it was a pretty risky kind of thing early on. You know, in contrast, when we're raising the very sort of the later rounds, like Series D and then going public, that could be a lot more based on metrics. And our revenues are just growing like really, really rapidly. And you could see lots and lots of evidence from the market. And so that was a very kind of different experience.
Did SoftBank Invest, was that the Vision Fund? That was the Vision Fund, wasn't it?
It ended up being the Vision Fund. The initial investment was not the Vision Fund. And we were actually their first life science investment. And they came in as part of our Series C, not a huge amount. And then later they transferred that investment, but it was considerably later, into the Vision Fund.
Was that just like everything else? Or do you have a Masayoshi Son story like the others, where it's like, I had a meeting in a lobby and we talked for 15 minutes and he gave me $1 billion?
Yeah, you know, like my experience is actually totally not that. It's funny. I never met with Masa. There was the person leading the investment was Deep Mishra, who is one of the people up there. He was at Google, he was at LinkedIn before that, and he is phenomenally smart and has been great. So like my experience has been actually quite different. I mean, he really kind of got deep into understanding biology and life sciences.
Right.
And yeah, we were, I mean, there were some dynamics. They always wanted to invest more than what we really had room for. And I think we sort of maintained our, did not go unnecessarily bigger than we needed to.
You didn't go real, real big. Yeah.
Not in terms of raising the money, because we didn't really need it.
Yeah. 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 And then just circling back to where you are today with the kind of the race for the COVID vaccine, can you give a sense of kind of where your machines are being used? Is it kind of all over the world? Is it by states? Is it by pharmaceutical companies? I don't know if there's like a kind of a flavor of that you can give.
Yeah, no. So like generally they're like everywhere, right? Global. Most of our focus has been on academic research. So like institutions, big, whether it's like big academic centers, genome centers, or academic hospitals, or smaller labs all around the world, all around the country, but also biotechs and pharmas. Those are a smaller fraction of our customer base, but definitely they are not an insignificant fraction. You know, it's interesting because we do have customers in China and quite a bit. And this is where we started seeing the effects of COVID first, where all of a sudden there's sort of a reorientation of research. You know, people ordering products.
You saw that. When did you start seeing that? Was that December?
No, it was later. January? It was January, February. I mean, there's a lag, right? For us, it's sort of like once people realize the seriousness of that, and once they realize, like, actually, we need to understand, like, what is going on with the biology here, then they start ramping up, and then they ramp up really fast.
Right. And this is probably a dumb question, but why does resolution matter? If you're thinking about using COVID as an example.
Yeah.
Why does being able to see this on kind of a single cell level matter?
Well, so what turns out is that all of biology is actually based around the fundamental unit of biology is the cell, the single cell. And all the different cells do all kinds of different things. And this is something that we didn't really see, like really until a few years ago. We sort of knew, but just how they're all doing different things is just something that's been a revelation to the world, and how much of that biology is happening there. And so, you know, the virus is going to enter particular types of cells that have particular types of receptors, and it's going to do particular types of things in those particular types of cells. And that's what we're learning across the board. And then the immune system itself is like this huge, like really complex orchestra of all kinds of different cells doing all kinds of different things. And that's where the thing becomes a black box when you're not looking at it at the single cell level. You can only measure very fragmentary parts of, you know, the proverbial elephant.
Right. I'm just trying to kind of conceptualize this in my head. So like Single cell, that's, how does that compare to, I don't know, say 5 years ago or 10 years ago in terms of what we were able to see and understand about, say, how a vaccine works or it doesn't work? Or is it kind of like you kind of throw a bunch of stuff against the wall, see what works, make sure it's safe, and then you're like, well, I'm not really sure how this is working or where this is attaching or what it's doing. We just know it's working, and now we can prove it safe, and now we can put it out into
the world. I think that's a really good way to look at it. I mean, it's not quite as extreme as that because we could measure some things, but basically it's a lot more guesswork and hoping for the best and testing a lot of things until something works and then kind of testing it to make sure. Whereas now you can mechanistically understand why things are happening, what is actually going on, why some patients, like what is the difference between patients that respond, that are responding well, and the patients that have severe symptoms. And I mean, we're actually seeing these. I mean, there are dozens of papers now coming out of China, and now they're appearing in other places where people are actually seeing very clearly that, okay, this is what's happening in the lungs of mild cases, and the immune system is producing these kinds of cells to be fighting the virus. And clearly the immune system is, like, in a very specific way, is doing something different in the severe cases. We can actually tell what kinds of cells and where they're present that the virus is infecting. What is it that's allowing it to infect some cells and not others? Kind of looking at the rate, how do the cells that get infected respond, something that you could never see before single cell analysis, because all of that just gets washed out.
Is there work being also done on this kind of asymptomatic people? Because that's, I was talking with somebody the other day, and kind of what's so insidious about this situation is that, you know, it sounds like a lot of people are asymptomatic, but can still shed the virus and spread it. And it sounds like that's a large number of cases.
Yep.
But surely if you can drill down to that single cell level on extreme cases, mild cases, or asymptomatic cases, and maybe there's some kind of commonalities there that you can start to try to kind of mimic with drugs.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I don't know how much people are looking at asymptomatics right now, because you first need to detect them, right? And you need testing infrastructure. But that's coming. And that's precisely right. Like, you kind of see... You want to figure out, like, why is it in the patients that, or people that don't get symptoms, how do you map that biology into the patients that get symptoms, right? That's an absolutely natural thing to do. I'm sure that's happening now. I wouldn't necessarily know.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
What was your worst day of work ever?
The worst days were when we had great people leaving the company. And this was kind of in the earlier days. But there was a period when we were going through some really difficult kind of organizational growing pains. It's something that I had read previously, but happens to startups. And you kind of figure it's like, we're gonna be fine. We're like totally.
Great. We got a super happy team, and everybody feels really valued, and we're all growing in the same
direction. And we figure things out together, and we just and then yeah, there was a point where things were just not working, and this is my first time I was doing this, right? I've not been a CEO before, and you kind of realize, and I, you know, to some extent, I missed the boat for, like, I again thought we were going to be fine, and then things started happening, and the red line for me was when, like, really awesome people started leaving, and that was just like, it's funny because to me, every one of those times when a great person leaves the company, it feels like I'm getting fired. There was periods where that was just happening a lot. And that was really, that was by far the hardest.
Was there something you had to fix or a blind spot that you had to kind of find and kind of address?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, part of it is just kind of appreciating what my job was in a different way. That wasn't just, I kind of saw myself like I was pretty good at solving problems. So I had to appreciate that that's not enough when being a leader. You also have to point to where the company is going, and you have to communicate. And it's not enough to just know what to do. You have to make it clear to people as well. And then, there's some things around our culture that were absolutely the things that made us successful early on that had to change once we got larger. And that was really hard to appreciate. The things that make you successful are the last things you want to discard, right? But it turned out some of them.
Right. Well, that's, because it's like it gets you that far.
Exactly.
And then being like, we're not going to do that anymore.
Exactly.
I feel like most people don't make that change. It's counterintuitive in a way.
It's both counterintuitive. And I had to kind of figure this out myself. And then it's also incredibly painful because that means some of your most cherished beliefs and people are no longer right for the company. That was an incredibly painful process, both emotionally and intellectually, to force yourself to figure this out and then to proceed with what you kind of decided was the right course of action.
Do you use a CEO whisperer or one of these coaches that they have out here that help people through these? Because it's obviously you're not the first person to go through these.
Yeah, no, I mean, for sure. I've got a pretty good support network and something around me. I definitely rely on the board for advice and help, and I have other people as well. And yes, coaching is a pretty important, oftentimes underrated aspect. Yeah.
Thank you very much for taking the time. Stay safe.
Yeah, you too. That was fun. Thank you.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Serge for taking the time, especially on one of his very few days in the office. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I hope you're staying safe. I hope you're staying inside, even though it is truly crazy making and really difficult. But hopefully we'll be out of this mess soon. But it kind of feels like this is going to be what we're doing for a while. But anyhow, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Like I said, I'm going to endeavor to get you another pod out in the next few days. So keep an eye out for that. And in the meantime, please keep the reviews coming in. It's really helpful. And I just really appreciate hearing from people what they think about the show. So go to Apple Podcasts, give 5 stars. It helps other people find it. You can also find me online. I'm writing about a bunch of stuff this weekend in the newspaper. Go online at thetimes.co.uk. Easier than buying a paper these days. And you can also find me on Twitter at Danny Fortson, or email me at danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk. That is all I have for you today. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk soon.